From England to Poland, every step across the ocean, the ruling classes, them is in a mess. Oh yes, the capitalist system a regress, but the Soviet system now progress. So which one of them you think is best? When are the two of them the workers a contest? When crisis is the order of the day, when so much people crying out for change nowadays. So what about the working class, comrade chairman? What about the working class? They bear the car, they carry the cross, and them not go forget them tongues in Gadangs. Them not go forget them tongues. From the east to the west, to the land I love the best, the ruling classes, them is in a mess. Oh yes, crisis is the order of the day. The workers, them demanding more pay every day. The peasants want a lot more say nowadays. The youth, them rebelling everywhere. Everywhere, insurrection is the order of the day. There's a lot of people crying out for change nowadays. Nobody blame it on the black working class, Mr. Racist. Blame it on the ruling class. Blame it on your capitalist boss. We pay the cost, we suffer the loss. And we not go to get new cross, not a ross. We not go to get new cross.
That's London-based Jamaican dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson with What About the Working Class? His own rant about the intersection of race, class, culture, and politics, delivered in his customary Jamaican patois set against reggae and reggae rock music of producer-artist Dennis Bovell. It's from his 1983 album, Making History. Now 62, Linton Kwesi Johnson has been doing performance poetry since 1978, and it has won him international acclaim and many, many awards. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, September the 9th. My goodness. And a kind of an eclectic program, an esoteric exercise for you today. As we talk about this great speech that is about to be delivered tomorrow. There's a lot going into it. Great hype, great coverage about the speech. And indeed, it is historic, but not for the reasons that people think or that the media are telling us that it is going to be a momentous for, noteworthy for. Today, President Obama briefs congressional leaders, bipartisan leaders in Congress, of his plans for military action against the Islamic State, and it is a lead-up to his much-anticipated speech to the nation and to the world tomorrow night on the same subject. Well, we have been numbed here by Obama's many political speeches. We've studied them and found out very interesting characteristics about his speeches. And to that degree, we won't see too much of a departure, I don't think. It would be a pleasant surprise if we find the speech for a change heavy on content as opposed to cadence tomorrow. But just the same, there will be great historicity attached to this speech, great gravity attached to the speech. And it has really nothing to do with the content of the speech. It has to do with the timing and the time, the moment in time, and the impact that the speech would have. Because in a sense, this speech will mark a dramatic change in the world. And that is really what we want to hone in on today. Sometimes you're in a historic moment and you don't really quite understand it or realize it, but this is going to be a historic moment. It may not feel like one, it may not look like one, and it may have all the trappings of propaganda and so forth, and all those things will be true. But it nonetheless is a historic moment because not only will President Obama himself have gone through a decisive, a BC-AD moment, a clear-cut division in his term as president, the nation itself would have gone through, as of tomorrow, a very dramatic change and shift, and so will the rest of the world. But there is more to this than meets the eye, and we see it evidenced in very nuanced ways. For example, just last night, the president hosted a dinner at the White House with a whole bunch of national security and foreign policy dignitaries and people who have been in three administrations, maybe even more, in this realm, operating in this realm. And he made a big deal about it. Of course, it was covered by entities like the New York Times and so forth, people of that ilk. It's a very elite group that got together for din-din last night at the White House. And today, of course, he is talking with leaders of Congress. He's not talking to your run-of-the-mill members of Congress. Leaders of the Senate, leaders of the House. And, of course, this is occurring as a lead-up to the speech tomorrow, which will be given on the eve of the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. So all of this is carefully choreographed because there is a consciousness of the historicity of it all, that there's something dramatic that is about to happen here. What we want to do today is to put on our analytical hats and deconstruct the moment. I'm not holding out any hope that there would be some dramatic shift in the content of what the president will say. We're not even going to speculate on what he will say. We will deconstruct the moment because in a very visceral way, this brings us all to a definitive, intertwined, unavoidable point of reckoning. Now, what do I mean by that? The president, as of tomorrow, will no longer have any wiggle room to do whatever it is he wanted to do otherwise. He will be committed, and he will have changed the tenor and tone of his presidency as of tomorrow, whether he wants to or not. The electorate, we the people, will be on the receiving end of that change. And our lives as Americans will go along with that change. Our lives will have to adjust to that change. So we are locked in this whether we want to be or not. And therefore, the decisions have to be made at some point as to what will our position be after whatever it is announced tomorrow. What will be the point of reckoning for us as of tomorrow? So that's what I'm hoping that we can decipher. What do we make of the moment that we're in? And to do a kind of sober analysis of that very thing. What is it? What is the moment that we're occupying now? What does it look like? What is the political reality of the moment now? What are we facing? That's deep, isn't it? But it actually is basic, good old-fashioned political theory and analysis. But it really, from time to time, we have done an exercise like this a couple of times before. It wasn't broached in this way, but we really did do it. So I'm asking you to put on your thinking caps again, and let's dive into this deconstruction of the moment that we're in. What is the environment of the speech? Remember, we always talk about the environment of a speech. What is it? What will the president be addressing? And most importantly, and I want to see if anybody gets this, what is not being articulated here, but that is so vital to understand about where the president actually is? 888-874-4888. Can you help us deconstruct this moment? Can you help us understand what, in part, fuels the president's thinking in the state that he is in and what he's about to say and do? And I'm particularly interested to see who gets it today. Who will be the person winning that prize to unearth the unarticulated factors that must be considered to make sense of this whole thing as it happens tomorrow? Who is going to be the person to nail it today? Will that be you? I want the best of your brain cells today. 888-874-4888. We'll take the first call as soon as it comes in. And in the meantime, I just want to give you a couple of clues. Mind you, a lot has been said. The president has taken a lot of lumps for vacillating and dithering and seeming unable to make up his mind and to be resolute in his action, not just about the Islamic State, but a number of issues, both domestic and foreign. He has had a number of issues to deal with, even in his own cabinet. We have a fast-moving cabinet, people moving in, people moving out. All kinds of things are happening in Washington. We have a non-working Congress. We have all kinds of issues that are crowding in and all demanding attention and all demanding urgent attention. Now comes this issue, and the president now has to go into a different mode. Is he ready for it? Is he able to carry it through? What do you think that the president is actually thinking? Or, more accurately, what do you think the people who handle the president, what are they thinking? What is the priority list looking like? And what is the moment that we are in, that we share with the president as Americans? We're all in the soup together in one degree or another. We may not agree with the president at all. I certainly am not a fan. But we are nonetheless affected directly by policies that he makes. And so to that degree, we are hooked in. We have to somehow tread water just the same, no matter what the decision is that comes down tomorrow. But looking at things in the broad context, looking at the complexity of issues, what do you see as the most important things that will be key factors in not only his decision, but in your decision as well? That's deep. That is very deep. 888-874-4888. I see people are a little hesitant today. Normally you jump at the chance to do this kind of thing, but maybe you too are thinking, because this is different. This is not your basic, I will furnish you with the answers and the ideas. No, this is you doing the work of deciphering and deconstructing the moment. And you tell us what it is that you see as the hidden factors that are most important to consider. Nobody's talking about it, But why is the president going to all this, going through all of this deliberate effort to appear to be very, very encompassing of all thoughts and views and getting input from all over the place? Is this normal? Is this something particularly important that requires his approach to be very different this time around? All right. Okay. I also, while I wait for calls from you, I want to touch on a couple of things. I did say this month we will be attempting to aggressively expand the reach of this program and, by extension, the reach of the PRN audience. And so I would be asking each of you to take on a little responsibility, a little burden of, but I hope a happy one, to in effect, be ambassadors for the program and for the station. And you will be asked to form just a little kind of network of your own, telling people that you know, people that you interact with on a regular basis, about the program, what you get out of the program, and why they should tune in and download. I'm happy to report that we are approaching the 380,000 download mark, and that's very, very comforting, especially since we really haven't done an aggressive marketing plan. You know, we have a campaign, I should say. We haven't done that. So it's time to do it, and I'm going to be asking you for your help in doing so. So about the middle of the month, that begins. So I hope when I do come to you, you would be amenable to joining. I'll just open up the lines. If you don't wish to talk about that, you want to talk about whatever you want to talk about, that's fine. But I thought that that would be very important for us to discuss. And if not, I will kind of lay it out the way I see it. But I don't want to monopolize the conversation. That's not right. When I do, you'll know. But this is meant for you to help us all understand what is going on here. And I don't want to give away the answer either. 888-874-4888. Okay. Did we lose? I'm okay. I'm fine. All right. You know, sometimes where I am, it rains very, very heavily, very, very, lots and lots of lightning, lots of thunder, and that's what's happening here right now. And I understand that I just lost you for 1 second because the connection sometimes goes a little nuts when these things happen, but they happen quite regularly now. This is hurricane season, and we get our daily share of very, very cruel weather with a lot of violent thunder and lightning, and that's what's happening here now. So bear with me if we just kind of drop out for a minute. We'll reconnect again. All right, so Bilal, I'll get the ball started. I think President Obama, it has finally caught up with him, the fact that he actually has to do something dramatic. And it is not in his nature, I don't think, to eagerly embrace such a charge. His record as a U.S. As a state senator in Illinois showed that he is not very eager to be penned pinned down on a vote. His most frequent vote was as present, not yea, not nay, but just merely present. That was the vote that he most often cast when having to vote on issues in the state Senate. And that was a signal that he just likes the idea of having a lot of wiggle room and being non-committal. So that is his profile. That looks to be his profile. When you're president, you have to make certain kinds of decisions that call for resolute action. And although he got elected on the same thing, making, you know, amorphous statements, amorphous kinds of promises and talking to people in very broad terms without much specificity, which gave him a lot of wiggle room to fix things if he had to come back to them, or, you know, to explain his way out of a situation. But that doesn't work well at that level, at the presidential level. You have to make a decision. And since it has been his political profile to leave a lot of things kind of just hanging in the wind without gelling them, without making them finite and concrete, it is very, very difficult for a president with that kind of a political profile to change it dramatically. Now, here's something very, very significant. When in this, his sixth year in office, the president has basically been dealing with the cumulative effect of that kind of lack of specificity about things. It's been irritating to people, but it didn't matter to him because the record still shows that he wasn't here or there about something. He was somewhere in the middle. And until forced to articulate a specific opinion or specific way in doing something, he would tend to avoid it. I think that this situation that he's in, which is why he still is reaping the reaction of people saying, "Well, wait a minute, how could you say you have no strategy for something this enormous in terms of world and global implication? How could you not have a plan as a head of state? And with all of the assets and resources that you have, people who are in a position to help you make a plan, and you still say you don't have a strategy." So he's doing a lot of this now, catching up with the mere silliness of the idea that a head of state in this global time, playing such a major role on the global stage, has no idea of how to confront a global problem, but at the same time is involved at a global level in dealing with the problem. You see, it's the same kind of anomaly that has hounded him much of his political life. But what is particularly coming out, at least to me, is fear. This president is fearful. And he's fearful, in effect, of going, basically making a step on his own. He has to be given assurances that he's not upsetting anybody. He has to be sure that he's not stepping on toes, that he's got the backing of everybody, that nobody really will hate him for what he does. And that, I think, has fueled a lot of this, you know, no man's land kind of approach to policymaking. And that, I think, is why he has been seeking all this advice from all over the place. It's not that he needs it necessarily, but that he wants people to see that he is not doing this on his own. Because it is not because he believes in a democratic approach to doing it. It is because he's fearful. He's fearful of taking a decision of such enormous significance. And here's the kicker. It is absolutely clear to this president, even though he will never say it, it is absolutely clear to him that he occupies a very uncomfortable place for him in history. He does not want to be not just the first African-American president of the United States. He does not want to be the black guy who starts World War III. He just doesn't want it. That is a huge piece of this puzzle. And because he knows the nature of the world, the nature of the world is everybody would say, yes, 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 go to war, go to war, go to war. Bomb them to smithereens. Bring out the big guns. Let's pulverize them, or whatever it is they say, like in McCain style. Let's just, or Joe Biden style. From both sides of the aisle, they'll be telling them, let's do this, let's do it, let's do it. But in the end, it hasn't been lost on this president that he is, in fact, the first African-American, if you want to call it, as president of the United States. And he will then occupy a singular place in history as the man, the first African-American president of the United States, who also began the chain of events that led to enormous global conflict. The same people who are telling him now, yes, go ahead and do this, yes, go ahead and do that, will turn on him in a minute. And what he has had to do as a president that no other president really has had to do is to publicly state validation. Even as president, as an African-American man, although he's a biracial man, but as an African-American man, he dare not let this be known as a singular decision. It has to be clear to the United States and the Americans and to the world that this is not of his singular doing. And he has had to take on a burden that no other president in the United States, in the history of the United States, would have had to do to validate a decision that is commensurate, at least theoretically, with the authority of his office. He still has to show that he has the permission of white America, that he has the validation of white America to essentially carry out the will of white America. Now, that's the heavy part of this whole thing. It would never be said, but that's it. A large part of the pull and tug between the president and Congress and the Senate and so forth, a large part of this is centered on this very notion. It is not expressed. It is not expressed. A large part of the struggle over who has authority and who does not have authority has to do exactly with this. The centrality of race, even at the presidential level. And he, in effect, understands it. He understands it so well that he's had to go through all of this. He can't say it, and they won't say it, but everybody knows it. Even even as president, he has to demonstrate that he is seeking permission, validation, and that he is not even daring at all. He poses no threat to the standing order by acting within his authority and acting singularly within his authority. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Trace?
Fine, thank you.
All right, I guess I'm going to be the first brave soul to tackle this question.
come on, brave soul.
Well, you know, most of what you said, I kind of thought about, and yes, the problem is that his indecisiveness in this particular situation, I guess he's trying to be the first president, maybe since Carter, I'm not sure, to not have an overt war or putting troops on the ground somewhere and having military action. Because I think it's been expressed before that Obama is the type of president who loves covert war. And he hasn't really, like, deployed troops or, you know, sent troops out to particular areas to resolve political issues. But I think that's what you're saying is kind of like hitting on the head of he doesn't want to be the first black man to start World War III, which I think we're probably in the early stages of. I don't think it's there yet, but if we look at past wars in history, you know, there's a lot of things that are precursors to particular wars. I mean, who would have known back in the 1930s that the Spanish Revolution would be a precursor to the, you know, to World War II, or the war in the Balkans be a precursor to World War I. So this right here, and especially with his decision that he's going to make in regards to ISIS, could be the precursor to World War III. But like I said, and, you know, I agree with you, I think he's just really, really afraid to make this decision. And you're right. With all the media attention going on with this, you know, beheading video, you know, showing this, because the one thing you have to have with a country, you have to have some sort of propaganda to the citizens of that country to have a cause to go into war. You just can't go into war without the approval of the nation. And I think he's steadily building, well, the media's steadily building this war, you know, with showing this beheadings and showing all the terrible thing ISIS is doing. And, you know, it's gaining traction with the people. So once he can get that, you know, once he can get that approval, you know, he'll go in, you know, I guess he'll finally make his decision to go, you know, full in on this war.
I don't know if he will go full in on the war, but the thing is, the pull and tug is that, in effect, the decision has been handed to him. He hasn't been in front of it, so in a way he has to deal with the consequences of his own dithering. But at the same time, he's been handed the decision. You got to do it.
Yeah. And you know what? And that's the thing about it. He's been handed the decision a while ago, and he's been sitting on it for a while. And like I said, in my viewpoint, I think he's basically waiting for the traction of approval to come through before he finally just says, okay, let's do it. I mean, that's the way I see it.
Okay, but when you say traction, he's waiting for on traction of approval, but from whom?
Generally, from the basic American public. I mean, for a while we've been, you know, we haven't had overt war going on in some years now. You know, like I said, basically most of it has just been covert. But you know, the thing is that. Like I said, with all the stuff that ISIS is doing, and they're showing this on, you know, TV, I think, and media, I think now the approval rating for, you know, going to war is starting to go up a little bit more. The more and more we hear about, you know, the tortures and the killings that these people are doing over there.
Okay, great points. Thank you very much, Henry, for your call today.
Thank you.
I think we are on the same track here. But at the same moment, well, let's take this call. Let's see if we could get from Mike, the holy grail here. Mike from D.C., you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Now, I'm just going to give you my take on things, and you can let me know if I'm on the right track. But to your point about the Obama's domestic dilemma, yeah, the race thing is always going to be at the forefront, and particularly with this president because of his background. But I always like to tell people the Obama that they projected is not the Obama that is in reality Obama. Like, Obama has more in common with Europeans than he does with African Americans. So I'll leave that domestic thing alone. But in terms of what's going on now, we have to understand that there is a reason why these videos and this particular entity called ISIS is being pumped at us right now. What is going on now is all orchestrated. And the reason I say that is because if you think about it, World War III started with 9/11. Let's be clear about that. World War III started with 9/11, and the war has been waged on many fronts. I think the Republicans had this thing called the Project for the PNAC, which outlined exactly what's going on now. The color revolutions, all that stuff that went on, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, all of this, it's a continuation if you look at it. All of these things are being continued. Obama is simply like a manager. He's trying to manage the public's perception and trying to keep things from blowing up entirely until they're ready. But make no mistake about it, this stuff is orchestrated. It's not, none of this stuff is being done randomly. And Obama making a speech on the eve of 9/11 at this time regarding this topic, it's, like you said, it's very calculated.
But what is it calculated to do?
I think it's calculated to basically make the public maybe more aware of where we're at this point in history. Like, the shift that has been occurring, it's getting ramped up, and we're getting ready to go into probably a more overt war, like the caller was saying. We've had covert wars. We've had wars where they've been undercover, and they've been happening in other places. But perhaps now he could be bringing it home and letting us know that this is going to be coming home, that we're going to have to deal with it on more than the typical levels that we're used to.
Okay, now, let's go with your theory. I don't disagree, by the way. I think it's a very astute observation that you're making. Mm-hmm. The question is, okay, is this a historic moment? Is this a definitive moment, you think, or you think it's just a continuum? Is this a moment where there will be a definitive turn in direction both, nationally and probably, of course, globally for the United States?
Well, if you think about it, it all depends on whose perspective you're looking at this from. The people in Ukraine, in the eastern Ukraine right now, you can't tell them they're not in the midst of World War III, right? They're already in the midst of it. Obama, I just don't really put a lot of emphasis on him, because we all know that Obama is not where the true power lies. Obama is, he's like Reagan. He looks good, and he makes good speeches, but we know that he's not the one that's really calling the shots. We know this.
He's not. All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Great
sure.
stuff today. Thank you. From New York, Allie, you're on the air.
Hi, you trees. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Okay, I'm doing well, thanks. My question to you is, how many wars the United States have won?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean,
on the last two, let's just say that they call it war. I don't call them because we invaded those countries. We invaded Afghanistan, and we invaded Iraq. Even though people call them wars, which I don't consider them wars, but those two, they were two big failures. So do you think that Obama wants to have his name out there, put it on World War III? Because you know what? Right now, that will be a disaster. I don't know if he's going to call it, because he's being pushed, especially by somebody like McCain and all these other people, Kerry, and all these other people. But the name, at the end of the day, history will put his name on it. It's not going to be those other people that are calling for those wars. And look what happened. Right now, it's not only ISIS. You're talking about Syria. You're talking about Iraq. You're talking about Afghanistan. You're talking about Ukraine. So it's like an octopus. So how many countries we going to grab and we're going to invade? And we don't even talking about Latin America, because we don't even know what's going on in Venezuela, in Honduras, where look what happened in Honduras right now. Look what happened, how many kids are coming to the border from Latin America. So I'm very, very surprised if Obama called for World War III. I mean, where are we going to end up? Who's going to go? I have one son and one son only, and I always tell him, you called yourself American, and you are an American. But you know what? At the end of the day, I wanted to see how many people, how many of those people they're serving in the Congress are sending the kids out there. If we get attacked, I believe you should put your uniform and defend the country. But why are we going into those lands, invading? And then who's paying for it? Us. Black people, African-American and Latinos, brown people. Those are the people that they go out there to defend the so-called democracy. And what is happening here? They're killing somebody like Eric Gardner, Michael Brown. They're killing our own people here. So I don't understand why we're going into those countries to kill these people, all the brown people too, that they really haven't done anything to us. For the oil, for Mobil, for the Shell, for this big elite corporation. So that is my thought right now on that.
Let me ask you, should the United States, or should the president in any way take action against the Islamic State?
No, because
Even though the Islamic State has vowed and has said that they will be attacking the United States, they have begun very, very vicious programs in many countries already, exterminating thousands of people in brutal ways in order to establish their own set of what they call a caliphate or their own religious or Islamic rule or kingdom, if you will. But even so, the United States should not be attacking the Islamic State.
Let's just go back to what United States have done, not only in the Middle East, but in Central South America. Look what the United States have done in those countries. They have helped and trained the military to attack their own people. What the United States have done in those Islamic countries, especially ISIS, they have been supplying those arms to the so-called rebels, what they call it. And then when they go to one place, they call them rebels. But then when they go to another place, they say they're attacking us. They're not the same people that they help in Syria to attack the Syria government, and now they are in Iraq, but now we have to attack them. And a lot of the ammunition, a lot of the military, we have been supplying them, the military giving them ammunition to use it against their own people. Look what happened in Libya. Libya is a perfect example of what United States have done. United States and the NATO. What did they do? They took these men out, and look what's happening. How many different groups of tribes are controlling Libya right now? So it's our own fault that we have supplied these people and helped them to go against their own government. And now we're saying they're attacking us? You know what? When you do something against other people, remember, there's always retaliation. And that's one thing that we should always think about. Whatever you do to other people, remember, people are always going to remember, and they're going to come back to you.
Thank you very much, Ellie, for your contribution today. Thank you. From New York, Joel, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Utrecht?
Good, good.
I'm glad to hear that. You know what? As I look back at all of the events that have occurred over the last 14 years leading up to what he is going to say on TV, I think about, everything that happened. I think about the emergence of al-Qaeda, yet al-Qaeda was insufficient for American policy. U.S. elites needed to war against the Taliban in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. Saddam Hussein wasn't enough. George Bush's Bring 'Em On engendered new and revitalized old Sunni and Shia militias. The PLO was an inadequate bogeyman. American policy demonized Hamas too. Colombian drug runners were inadequate. Washington added the FARC. When Gaddafi had to go, NATO got tribal gunmen and Benghazi in the bargain. When Bashar al-Assad's time was up, the jihadis poured forth. So propagating an endless stream of new enemies transforms war into a kind of permanent enterprise. And that's the way it's been my entire life and all of our lives. And this enterprise generates trillions in debt, billions in profits, and millions of security clearances. New bureaucracies are built. Old bureaucracies are strengthened and expanded, and militarization transforms formerly civilian police forces, as we have seen, and once quiet international borders. Now, I know that warmongering politicians and pundits have plagued humanity probably since the Peloponnesian War, and American war profiteering is older than the American public, and imperial interventions really began in the War of 1812, and perennial preparations for war have been a central feature of American life since the Truman administration. Truman increased the military budget by 400% in 1950. What changed is that the American way of war, once subject to the constraints of time and space, has been liberated from its earthly shackles, I think. American war, like the U.S. economy, has gone digital, global. It seems
But Joel, where does this put the president at this moment now? What is the moment that he's occupying now?
I think what I'm trying to say is that U.S. foreign, and this is, I think, the basis of what he's going to say tonight, U.S. foreign and defense policy has become a new enemy creation process, always hungry, ever alert. The Islamic State is almost too good to be true for the war on terror industrial complex. And I think that Obama will reportedly, quote, declare war, you know, actually not declare it, but express the nation's intent on going to war on the Islamic State. In fact, I took a look at the New York Times the other day, and a senior unnamed administration official, as they always call them, told the Times that the campaign against ISIS may last at least 36 months. And if you think about it, the CIA spent most of the 80s across the border in Pakistan in support of armed groups that would later become al-Qaeda, such as the Taliban. The U.S. military has been in Afghanistan since 2001. U.S. military forces and intelligence agencies have been in, over, and around Iraq with varying degrees of lethal intensity since 1990. So there's no reason to believe the ongoing war against IS won't be as boundless or last as long, that is, without limits in time or space. Now, U.S. peace groups are profoundly familiar with all of this, with the institutional, political, economic, and ideological changes necessary to stop creating new enemies. And I think the American public is dog-tired of endless war, and I think some of the calls that you got sort of suggest that. If only the former could energize the latter. So
that's the eternal wish. Just the same, as we wind up here, what do you make of the intersection here? What do you make of what President Obama's role is, as you see it now?
Well, I think that you know, I prefer to really talk about policy. I think he's going to institute this policy. I think that he is going to start, you know, continue the aerial operations against them in northern Iraq and Kurdistan. Who knows, you know, what the unintended consequences of this are. What happens if ISIS forces start moving aggressively south from the Golan Heights where they are now? What are the Israelis going to do? You know, so I think to a certain extent he's going to be, once he starts this, like everything else that was started over the last 14 years, you become the executive becomes a kind of a victim of unintended consequences. I know that Bush was, you know, was dense and his administration was living in fantasy land, but even they couldn't foresee all of the things that happened in Iraq, although many other people did. I think, you know, it's going to be a kind of quagmire. All I know is that the public has had it. And it really is the obligation of those of us on the outside who are involved with the politics of reality and the politics of life to meet our obligations and to energize the public and raise their consciousness about all of the things that are happening. I mean, consider the critical problems that the country is facing, a mega drought in the United States. We've never had this before. We're going to see an endless displacement of people over the next decade. We're going to see increasing famine as all of the arable lands in California and other parts of the West dry up. It's incredible. It's incredible that the real issues facing the world and the American public are not really faced. Instead, they fantasize by creating these other things. And it's all predicated on the political economy of war.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You put the nail on, you hit the nail on the head, as it says. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Well, we will continue the discussion. We kind of got to a late roll here on the program today, but this continues tomorrow because I think it is a very apt lead-in to the speech tomorrow night, but also leading into the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, but also to where people ought to be now, as Joel just said. What should the consciousness be? And what should we make of the time that we're in now? This is a very, very important moment. And we should not lose the historical significance of it. Not only for, you know, of course, the chronology of the time, but also the fact that we are in a period where we can do something. We can do something to change the future, the chronology of the future, and that is important. Thank you so much for joining me today. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to stay tuned for that? Drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. A pleasure and a privilege, as always, to be in your company. Thank you so much for today.
So what about the working class, Comrade Chairman? What about the working class? They bear the car, they carry the cross, and them nab up to get them tongues in Gadangs. Them nab up to get them tongues. From the east to the west, to the land I love the best, the ruling classes them is in a mess. Oh yes, crisis is the order of the day. The workers them demanding more pay every day. The peasants want a lot more say nowadays.